Hello and welcome to the Science Podcast for January 23rd, 2009. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, increased death rates for trees in the Western United States, evidence from languages and bacteria for how people populated the Pacific, and how your friends and other relations influence your health. All this plus a roundup of the latest science news from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, publishers of Science Magazine, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. The American Association for the Advancement of Science at www.aaas.org.
Trees and unmanaged old forests in the western United States are dying much faster than before, and that death rate continues to increase. In a paper in this week's Science, Philip Van Mantgam and colleagues report that the death rate has more than doubled since the 1950s. The likely cause, the researchers suggest, is regional warming and the subsequent stress on trees from drought and pests. I spoke with Van Mantgam from a conference in San Francisco. Van Mantgam is a research ecologist with the U.S. Geological Survey.
Have discovered that background mortality rates across western forests are increasing over the last couple decades, and that the likely driver behind that change in mortality rates is widespread increasing temperature.
Now, is this increase in death rates happening in all forests?
All the forests that we looked at, not individual stands, mind you. There's a lot of variability in it, but if we broke it out by region, and we sort of needed a large sample to detect this trend, so if we looked at we split it out sort of between biogeographic regions, say the Pacific Northwest, California, the interior Rocky Mountains, we are seeing that trend. I should emphasize, these are all old-growth, unmanaged forests. And the reason why we did that is that in managed forests, if you're thinning a forest, you'd expect a demographic response to that disturbance. You know, you'd see the same thing if you had a fire or an avalanche or anything that would sort of take out a bunch of mature trees. And so we only looked at sort of mature stands that people more or less think they're demographically kind of dull. You wouldn't expect to see big changes there.
How old are these unmanaged old forests?
It depends. It's variable. At least 200 years was our cutoff. Some much older than that, up to 1,000 years.
And the survey data of these unmanaged old forests started when?
It's variable across the sites. We started looking at data starting in the 50s because that's when we'd expect to start seeing a directional change. A couple of our stands, just a handful, started back in the 30s. We had one that started back in the 20s. Most of them started in the 1970s.
Is the death rate increasing in all the unmanaged old forest plots that you and your team had data for?
No, but most of them. Around 87%, according to our models, are showing increasing mortality rates. But, you know, that still leaves out some that where the mortality rate is declining. So there's a good deal of variability there.
And this increasing death rate means young and old trees are dying faster, different sizes of trees at different elevations, different species.
Exactly. That's one of the things we looked for immediately is, was this overall change in mortality rate, was that an artifact of just some segment of the population? So we looked at different genera. Again, we needed big sample sizes, so we couldn't take it really down to individual species. But all genera that we looked at showed that increasing mortality rate trend. We looked at sizes. All size classes showed an increasing trend. Yeah.
Now, you said that temperature was a likely contributor to this increasing death rate. What, if any, reasons for this increasing death rate have you and your team ruled out?
Well, one of the things that people have noted correctly about a lot of forests across the West is that fire suppression has caused an infilling of trees, especially in the understory. So a lot of small stems have come in since fire hasn't knocked them out over the last 100 years or so. And so one of the things that we're interested in is looking at what's called the historic fire return interval. So if you go back and using tree ring records, essentially figuring out how often prior to European settlement an area burned gives you a fire return interval. So that could range anywhere from a couple of years in some of the stands in Arizona to up to 1,000 years in some of the really wet stands around the Pacific Northwest. So using that variability, we figured that the stands that have the really long fire return intervals, you know, over 200 years, you wouldn't see any sort of effective fire suppression in those stands because they historically never burned anyway. And we still saw that increasing mortality rate. So that was the big one. Yeah, so just trying to rule out internal stand dynamics. There's a couple of other artifacts that we checked for as well. Things like what's called the majestic forest bias. You know, if people went out and preferentially put plots where there's big, pretty trees, some people speculated that you could see an increasing mortality rate as sort of an aging large cohort dies and falls over and smashes small trees. We didn't find any evidence for that.
What other reasons, then, might be behind this kind of increased death rates for unmanaged old growth forests?
Well, again, because we're seeing it at a subcontinental scale, it looks like some sort of mechanism is driving that also operates on a subcontinental scale. And we come back to warming. It's hard to, pin down exactly what's going on with that, because warming could cause a lot of changes. Warming could increase evaporative demand in these stands and then sort of effectively dry it out without any changes in precipitation. So that could be one mechanism whereby this is happening. Warming could also make the things that chew on trees a lot happier, things like bark beetles and fungi and things like that. So if those agents are more active, that could cause an increase in mortality rate. So I don't think it's one single mechanism, but warming, I think, is likely involved in a lot of those mechanisms once we start doing the more detailed work to follow up on this.
Is this then likely to be happening in other unmanaged old-growth forests at similar latitudes and elevations, or is this a regional phenomenon?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I could play out a couple different scenarios where you might see changes in, say, East Coast broadleaf forests, or you might not at this stage. Again, given the sort of rapidity and magnitude of changes that the climate models tell us are coming our way, I expect we'll start seeing changes sometime soon. Again, it was East Coast forests or a lot of sort of mid-latitude forests have been logged over, so it might be harder to detect any sort of directional change from an environmental influence.
So the evidence is consistent with this regional warming and, I presume, the consequent stress of drought.
Uh-huh.
How much has the temperature changed then in the area at these latitudes?
It's been around half a degree centigrade per decade. Again, it's going to be variable. These are complex mountain terrains that a lot of our study sites are located in. And so we wouldn't expect to see a uniform change at all these sites. There's a lot of complicating factors. So to actually look at climate at our sites specifically, we're using a model called PRISM that will interpolate the weather station data across those topographic features. So it takes into account lapse rates. So as temperature changes with elevation, rain shadow effects, that sort of thing.
Is it possible to reduce or reverse this death rate in some way? These are unmanaged forests. Would managing them help?
There are some things that managers could do, and we do have some recommendations, at least to reduce present threats that managers can control, things like exotic species, for example. Managers can go out and try to remove those as best they can. If you can get rid of exotic pathogens or another stress on forests, there's other things that they have no control over. Air pollution is another factor around here that plays a role. We weren't able to detect that in our study, but in certain sectors, it's certainly having an effect. So yes and no, I would say. We're used to thinking if we can restore historic conditions, then everything will be great. And the current thinking is now that maybe historic conditions aren't the most stable in the climatic regime that we're going to be experiencing in fairly short order. So this is a very challenging time to be a forest manager or a land manager in general.
Philip Van Mantgam, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Philip Van Mantgam is lead author of a paper on the increased death rates of trees in the Western United States. Read the paper in this week's Science. In two papers in this week's Science, research teams using different data have independently traced how early populations spread across the Pacific. Of course, there's nothing new about scientists confirming one line of evidence with another, but what is new is just how independent these two lines of evidence are. One of the papers relies on genetic evidence from strains of the stomach bacterium Helicobacter pylori, and the other rests on the similarities among hundreds of Austronesian languages. In a perspective in this week's issue, Colin Renfrew connects the two, telling how both local languages and stomach bacteria tell the same story of how people migrated out of Asia and spread across the Pacific. I spoke with Renfrew from his office at Cambridge University.
When it comes to the Pacific, the linguistic paper suggested that the Pacific populations of Micronesia and Polynesia, indeed all of Austronesia, their starting point was the island of Taiwan, the island of Formosa. And that's a matter that had been open to controversy. And the interesting thing is, and why the two are interesting to compare, is that the paper with the human bacteria in the human gut, the Helicobacter pylori, came to that same conclusion. Of course, they're dealing with different things. They deal with different things in a different way. And so I see that as a very powerful support from the analysis by Moodley and colleagues with the bacteria for the main basic conclusion of Gray and colleagues for the languages. So in this very interesting way, you get two completely different bits of research which are rather supporting each other.
Now, these two fields are, as you say, quite unrelated. Was there any data that both sets of researchers used?
Not really, except in order to try and put some dates onto the family trees which they created, they did then draw on archaeological data. But I think it's important to make clear that the linguistic paper essentially is using exclusively linguistic data to draw up a sort of family tree, a very elaborate family tree of all the languages of the Pacific in this language family, the Austronesian family. So that's one body of data. Then the other body of data is using the analysis, the DNA analysis, from the bacteria, from the gut of all these representatives of all these different populations, and they, using those data, produce a tree. And what is really interesting is that the trees are rather similar in shape, and each tree, independently, as it were, suggests that these Pacific populations were the result of human expansions out of Taiwan, out of Formosa. Then it's true that they do go on to say, right, let's date this. Then they have to use the available evidence for the dating, generally at the more recent end of the tree, and then they're able to extrapolate backwards to go to earlier times.
According then to both models, when did people leave Taiwan and what happened after that? Where did they go?
Well, they first of all left Taiwan around 5000 BC, and then they went down to the Philippines, and the linguistic picture is a much more refined one, a much more sensitive one, and there was a pause there, and then they must have learned to do some new things and so on, and then they moved out into the Pacific, into Micronesia, and then at the end of the line, as it were, they moved to Polynesia. And both analyses give a similar picture, but the linguistic analysis is very detailed at the Pacific end. The bacteria analysis also gives some very interesting information about earlier times, but what I was focusing on was the Pacific end, because that's where they converge, and that's where I think they will be significant in giving confidence to the use of these phylogenetic methods in historical linguistics.
Is this kind of computer phylogenetic modeling accepted by historical linguists generally?
Well, not altogether. I think it's fair to say that historical linguistics has been a rather traditional field. So there are a lot of very conservative historical linguists who I think are rather horrified by it. But Gray and his colleague Atkinson a few years ago published an article in Nature, that was in 2003, where they used very much these methods to look at the Indo-European language family, which of course covers most of the languages of Europe, as well as the former European colonies, Australia, North America, and so on. And they reached very striking conclusions for a much earlier origin for Proto-Indo-European than had generally been accepted by historical linguists. And that conclusion has not, I think, been accepted now by the majority of historical linguists, but I think one of the interesting things about the new work, although it's in a very different area, it's in the Pacific, the point is that because it seems to work in the Pacific and is being supported by this independent evidence, that feeds back in a way to the earlier Indo-European work and ought, I think, to encourage linguists to take that phylogenetic analysis of the Indo-European languages much more seriously than some of them have done.
To that bacterial evidence, as you said, it also supports the same human population spread in the Pacific as the language model. What's that evidence? Tell me a little bit more about this H. pylori evidence.
Well, it works in very much the same way as using human DNA, mitochondrial DNA or Y chromosome DNA. But the interesting thing about these bacteria, they are, of course, parasites in humans. Most humans are not deleterious or anything. Most of us have these bacteria in our gut. but one's analyzing bacterial DNA, not human DNA, and the methods used are in some ways similar. You compare one with another, and that is basically how you draw up a phylogenetic tree anyway, by seeing which things fit together, which are very similar, and if you're assuming gradual change, the ones that are very similar presumably had a common ancestor quite recently. The ones that are more different had a common ancestor further up the tree, as it were, further along the convergence of the branches of the tree. And so in this way, a picture is built up, which in a formal sense, if you're talking about the actual phylogenetic analysis, that is how you manipulate the data, it's very similar. And so it's interesting that it does give broadly supporting conclusions.
Now that these models apparently do independently confirm one another in Pacific populations, what's next? To try them on other populations?
Yes. There are two fields of research, really. The bacterial paper, the authors of that paper, are probably not all that interested in the Pacific languages. They were dealing with the broader field of how the Pacific was colonized, so they've also got interesting things to say about the colonization, first of all, of Southeast Asia, and then the subsequent colonization of Australia and New Guinea, something like 30,000 years ago. So they're talking about the whole picture of the spread of human populations in the world. And so when you say what's next for them, maybe they'll be able to tell us a little more about the first human population in the Americas, which has still not been fully resolved by human DNA analysis. As regards the linguistics, I think, yes, we hope that Gray and his colleagues will go on to apply these phylogenetic methods in other areas. They have already been very successfully applied to African languages, and so I think we're getting a much more clear and detailed view of the development of the languages of the world, which I think is going to have a major impact in historical linguistics.
Colin Renfrew, thank you very much.
Good.
Colin Renfrew writes on the peopling of the Pacific. Read his perspective, as well as the two papers we talked about, one by Moodley and colleagues about the bacteria research, and the other by Gray and colleagues on language phylogenies, in this week's Science. If you have a cold, flu, or other similar communicable disease, you'd probably avoid your friends and family as best you could to keep from passing it along to them, at least while you're contagious. Now, research by social scientists is showing that behaviors like obesity and smoking can be contagious, too. In this week's Science, Jennifer Cousin writes about the expanding theory that behaviors spread through social networks. I spoke with Cousin from her home office in Philadelphia.
A social network is essentially the people we surround ourselves with. Each of us has our own social network, friends, family, coworkers, neighbors, you know, acquaintances who we might run into periodically, and those are the people who we're connected to. So that's what a social network is. And this story was really looking at how social networks might influence our health in different ways, and also how social isolation might negatively affect our health. And there is some interesting new research going on in both of those areas that I tried to cover.
Other than health, what's an example of people's belief that social networks affect some change?
Well, for a long time, people have looked at social networks in school settings, actually, and in particular, looking at whether students in a school who are surrounded by other high-achieving students are more likely to do well than students who are surrounded by others who are underperforming. And although that's something that makes intuitive sense, as a lot of things do in social networks, it's very, very hard to prove because it's very difficult to show that one thing is causing another in a network, as there's so much else going on. For example, in the school, you might have involvement of parents, you might have where the school is located, you might have all sorts of other things that could be playing into an individual's performance. And so just isolating out, well, if the other kids are smart, is that affecting this particular student, is tough to do, but it's something that people have certainly looked at over the years.
And there's more evidence that social networks then are affecting health, that there aren't so many confounding factors like there would be in school settings?
Well, unfortunately, there are just as many confounding factors as there are in school settings. It's really an issue across any kind of social network, even across any kind of observational study, where you're just following people as they live their lives and there's so much feeding into their lives that it's hard to pull out specific factors. So with social networks, the issues that come up, what we think of as the confounding factors, are, for example, whether people just like to associate with other people who are like them. So I might, you know, want to associate with someone else who's a similar weight to me, and therefore, obviously, my weight isn't causing the other person's weight. We just happen to have the same weight. So that's one factor that needs to be considered. And another is that if you've got people in a social network who are in the same environment, in the same town, on the same block, they're obviously, if we're talking about weight, they maybe are eating at the same restaurants, shopping at the same grocery stores, and that could also be feeding, so to speak, into their weight. So these are some confounding factors that researchers like Nicholas Christakis of Harvard and James Fowler of the University of California at San Diego have had to take into account in their work.
And in their work, they've linked things like obesity, happiness, smoking cessation. They're saying these things spread among social networks much like a communicable disease would. Is that right?
Yes, and that's what's gotten them a lot of attention, is they're really comparing things that we don't think of as transmissible, you know, not contagious, and essentially saying in a way they are contagious. And in a network, what they saw based on the Framingham study network that has actually been around for a long time, but no one really knew that it existed, and that's the Framingham Heart Study, which is a 60 or so year old study that's been going on in Framingham, Massachusetts, to try and understand the different causes of heart disease and the different aggravators of heart disease. And these two, who had an interest in social networks and an interest in how social networks might affect different facets of health, they reported that, you know, if my friend or a social contact of mine gains weight, I am then more likely to gain weight. And even if it's a friend's friend or a friend's friend friend, 3 degrees removed, that still has a small but measurable effect on my weight gain or my chance of quitting smoking or my happiness or unhappiness. So they actually describe this spreading through networks of people.
Are there any traits that couldn't be altered by social networks in Christakis and Fowler's view?
In their view, the only traits, well, there certainly could be traits that one could look at and wouldn't find a spread for, but the only traits that we know can't spread are really traits that are entirely genetic, so traits that just can't change, like your eye color is a good example that they bring up. And otherwise, anything that can be influenced, even influenced very slightly by one's environment, could in theory, in their view, be affected by a social network.
Now, you said this article was also about social isolation. Is the idea that social networks are possible ways to improve health drawing support from research that social isolation is not good for one's health? So kind of a binary thinking. If being alone is bad, then having friends is good.
Yes, I think that is something that some researchers are certainly interested in. Now, it's not what Nicholas Christakis and James Fowler are looking more at, features that spread through an existing social network. And what social isolation is saying is if you don't really have much of a social network, what effect does that have on your health? And in a way, it's not that surprising that wouldn't be good for your health. But what some researchers have found is that it really increases your chance of a whole range of diseases, of dying earlier in life, if you are socially isolated.
How then could a person or doctor or institution modify social networks to change health for the better?
It's really difficult, and I think people are only just starting to look at that. When it comes to social isolation, that work has been around a little bit longer, and there's been a bit more of an effort to try and bolster networks to reduce isolation and then improve health, and that's been very difficult to do. There have been a couple studies in stroke and cardiovascular disease, which have been shown to increase with social isolation, to try and reduce them, and they have not worked. And one possibility is simply that if you're isolated for 20 years or 30 years, someone coming in and reducing that for a year or two isn't going to make much difference physiologically. It's also possible, in theory, that social isolation isn't actually causing ill health, since it is so difficult to show that one thing's causing another in a social network or an observational study. So people are trying to do that, and there's a big new study starting up in different workplaces that's trying to allow for more workplace flexibility and see whether that improves health or reduces social isolation and improves health in workers and their spouses and children. And as far as the spread through social networks, that's even newer, and there is some interest in trying to use that. One could imagine how you could use that to, say, reduce smoking, for example, or improve weight. but it's really difficult, and physicians are only just starting to become aware of this, so we don't really know where that's going to go.
Jennifer Cousin, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Science News writer Jennifer Cousin reports on friendship as a health factor. Read her article in this week's Science. Finally today, David Grimm, editor of Science's online daily news site, Science Now, joins us to talk about the latest science news. Hi, David.
Hey, Rob.
So what stories do you have for us today?
Well, Rob, we're going to talk about what happens in our brain when we follow the crowd, how crops may protect us from global warming, and finally, how an extinct tiger may not be so extinct after all.
Well, let's start with what goes on in the brain when we follow other people. I'm following your lead here. Is something happening in my brain?
Well, Rob, this study has to do with lemming-like behavior. And this is this idea, whether it be a political movement or a fashion trend, this very human tendency to do what others are doing or even think what others are thinking. And scientists have been trying to figure out what happens in our brain that causes us to want to sort of go with the flow, as it were. And some of this research traces back to a landmark study in 1951, where researchers drew two lines on a piece of paper, and one was obviously longer than the other. And they had subjects tell the researchers which line was longer. And they found if they told somebody that the group had reached a consensus that one line was longer than the other one, even if it wasn't, people tended to go with group consensus, even though on some level they knew that they were giving the wrong answer.
So contrary to their own opinion, they went with the group.
Exactly. And scientists since then have wondered whether this tendency to follow the group has something to do with the learning center of our brain. You know, perhaps we are learning to follow others, or we are learning not to make mistakes. People feel that when they go against the group consensus, even if they're right, they tend to feel anxiety. And perhaps there's something that goes on in our brain that says, you don't want to feel anxiety, you know, learn to sort of go with the group. And there's two regions of the brain that are involved with this learning system, what's called the rostral cingulate zone and the nucleus accumbens. And in the new study, researchers did a study similar to what was done in 1951, except in this case, instead of using lines, they used faces. They used 222 female faces, and they had 21 young women rank these faces as to how attractive they thought they were on a scale from 1 being least attractive to 8 being most attractive.
So much more a subjective test than the objective test of which line is longer.
Exactly. This was a more subjective test. But what was also similar was they told these women what the group consensus was. And this consensus was something the researchers actually made up. So they would say, well, you know, the group really thinks, you know, this particular face is very attractive or this particular face is very unattractive. And they wanted to see how that influenced the women's decisions. And indeed, just like with the line test, these women tended to go along with the group. So they tended to rank faces more attractive if the group had also considered that face more attractive and vice versa. But at the same time, the researchers used fMRI, which measures activity in the brain, while the women were ranking these faces. And what they found was that indeed, as they suspected, these two learning centers of the brain were activated. But they also found that an area of the brain associated with reward was less active when a woman's rating deviated from that of the group. So if one of the women said, this face is really unattractive, and then were told, well, you know, the group thinks this face is very attractive, this reward center of their brain didn't light up as much.
So what did the researchers really conclude here?
Well, there's two main conclusions. First of all, that our brain's learning center is involved in this groupthink behavior. But the other conclusion is that our decision to follow others has something to do with this feeling of reward. We want to feel good when we make a decision. And we tend to feel good if our decision matches up with that of the groups. And when it doesn't, we don't feel as good. And that may also explain why we feel anxious, even if we've got the right answer, if that answer doesn't match up with the groups.
So a physiological reason behind why there are so few nonconformists.
Exactly.
So now this next story is about how crops can protect us from global warming. What's the group think or consensus on that one?
Well, Rob, the consensus is that we've got to do something to protect our planet from warming up. And what a lot of people have proposed falls into this category of what scientists call geoengineering. And these are sort of technological proposals for how we can protect the planet.
Such as?
Such as, I'll give you a couple interesting examples. One thing that's been proposed is a $1 trillion space-based sun shield that would literally reflect the rays of the sun back out into space and cool the planet. Another proposal, which we actually wrote about last year, is having every roof in every major city in the world painted white as a way to reflect sunlight. And this new study is along those lines in that it's a way to reflect sunlight. But in this case, we're using something natural. We're using crops. And crops already do this. The waxiness of their leaves reflects sunlight back into the atmosphere. And this reflective property is known as albedo. And what a group of scientists wondered is there a way to increase this waxiness even further so we can increase this light reflection back out into space and potentially help cool the planet?
So geoengineering through bioengineering.
Exactly.
Well, I know corn has waxy leaves, but not all crops do. So how much of an effect are we actually talking about here?
Well, researchers looked at a broad array of crops. They looked at the major crop-producing parts of the world, which tend to be concentrated in North America and Eurasia. And they said, what would happen if we could increase the albedo of these crops by about 20%? And they found if they could do that, over the next 100 years, they could decrease regional temperatures in these areas by 1 degree Celsius. Now, that may not seem like a lot, but the effect is the same as eliminating 195 billion tons of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. Or if you want to think about it in more simple terms, it's the same as grounding 195 million plane flights from Los Angeles to New York.
So kind of a major carbon offset, it sounds like. But what's this do to the plants?
Well, it's a good question. And the researchers say that really all they're talking about doing is increasing the waxiness of the leaves. And the way you could do this potentially is just through selective breeding. You can just select those plants that have more waxy leaves and breed them and breed them and breed them until you achieve a plant that has very, very waxy leaves. But when we're talking about corn and other plants, we don't eat the leaves. So theoretically, it shouldn't be a concern for the consumer.
Although I suppose there still could be ramifications for the rest of the ecosystem, not just what we eat.
Sure. I mean, there's obviously animals out there that do subsist on the leaves of these crops. So that's something that would have to be taken into account.
Now, two ecosystems. In this next story, it sounds as though an apex predator, thought to be extinct, is back.
Exactly. And this final story has to do with tigers, which, as you said, are a top predator. But also tigers have been in a lot of trouble recently, and especially over the last 100 years, their population has declined substantially. In fact, in Asia, tigers are now gone from more than 90% of their habitat. And some of the subspecies of tigers have gone extinct. So when we say tigers, there's obviously more than one kind. There's the Siberian tiger and there's the Indochinese tiger. And scientists used to, when they had to classify these subspecies, they didn't have, you know, this is before DNA analysis, they would just go by looks and geography alone. So they would say, well, this tiger looks different from that tiger, so it's probably a different subspecies. Or this tiger lives in a different part of Asia than this other tiger, so it must be a different subspecies. And by doing that, scientists had decided there was about 8 subspecies of tiger. But in the past few years, when they started doing DNA analysis, they found of the tigers that are still alive today, there's only 5 subspecies. So that left 3 subspecies that were defined before, and scientists have been trying to figure out, well, how do they fit in?
So to do that, presumably they have tissue samples somewhere that can get DNA from these, what were at least thought to be different species of tigers that have now gone extinct?
Well, exactly. And in this particular study, they're talking about the Caspian tiger. And researchers have thought the Caspian tiger went extinct in about 1970. That was when the last one was thought to have been shot in Turkey. And as you said, there's about 20 odd museum specimens of this tiger. And researchers took tissue samples and they said, well, let's figure out if this guy was really a subspecies as we had thought before DNA analysis, or whether it belongs to one of the current subspecies that are still alive. And what they did was they looked at mitochondrial DNA, and this is sort of a fast-evolving DNA, which can really help you delineate between different subspecies. And what they found was there was only one tiny genetic difference between the Caspian tiger, which is extinct, and the Siberian tiger, which is alive and well. And basically what that means is the Caspian tiger and the Siberian tiger are one in the same. And in fact, the Caspian tiger didn't go extinct because it's still alive and well in the form of the Siberian tiger.
So they could introduce the Siberian tiger into the Caspian area to revitalize those populations.
Exactly. The parts of the world where the Caspian tiger has disappeared, you don't want to introduce a completely different type of tiger there because, you know, different types of tigers have evolved to deal with different ecosystems. But in this case, because you essentially have the same exact tiger alive and well in a different part of Asia, theoretically, you could just move some of those tigers to the Caspian range, and they should do just fine there. And that would be a great way, as you suggest, of repopulating that area with tigers.
Now, you said the last one was shot in Turkey in 1970. So presumably the people don't necessarily want the tigers back.
Good point. And actually, in some of these regions where they're thinking about introducing the Siberian tiger, don't have any people. And actually, they're very flush with prey. So a reintroduced tiger could theoretically do very well there.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for Science Now or on the policy blog, Science Insider?
Well, Rob, for Science Now, we're looking into a story about a dung beetle that has switched from eating dung to eating millipedes. And this is a very interesting and rare case of a scavenger becoming a predator. So very interesting implications for evolutionary biology. And on the Science Policy blog, we're looking into a proposal made by U.S. House Democrats last week to give $20 billion to science and scientific infrastructure in the United States. And we've got a very nice breakdown of what agencies stand to benefit the most from this funding. And also we've got an analysis of new education rules in the state of Louisiana, which could potentially introduce the teaching of intelligent design into the school curriculum. So be sure to check out the site.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the online daily news site of science. You can check out the latest science news, plus the latest science policy news on the Science Insider blog. Find a link at sciencenow.sciencemag.org. And that wraps up the January 23rd, 2009 Science Podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine and of AAAS, the Science Society. The content is provided by the news and editorial staff of Science, and Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.